not having a tan, I wish it was darker. Now I realize, like, it's literally the same light. I'm in the same room with the same light on.
It's
It's just,
amazing. It's so bright
I'm telling you,
and like
it's,
crystal clear. Oh my God.
I'm just, I feel like, because when I was doing Taylor Tillich Taylor's podcast, I was like, I need
Taylor
to
Tillich.
change Taylor Tillich. I need to change the books because she goes, or well, she didn't say anything, but we were talking about something, and I noticed I had Ayn
I'm like
Rand
leaning
on my
forward to read
shelf.
them. You have what
I
on
was
there?
like, Ayn Rand right here.
Oh no. Nope.
Which I have read. It's just that I was like, I wish it wasn't right
Right there.
there.
Yeah, that sends the wrong
Because
vibes for sure. It's a good thing
the
we're
and
not
then
on.
there's also Cricket for Dummies right here,
I should have used
nestled
that.
right beside a Flannery O'Connor book. So I'm organized.
My aunt, so I read both The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And Atlas Shrugged is currently it's being used as a like the base because on top of my bookshelf there's like a dip. And so if you put anything on the top of it, you can't see it. So I have it underneath the like the pretty thing.
It's a prop. You're
It's
using it as a
I'm using
prop.
it as a prop, holding up
Oh
a picture and a cross.
no. Oh, I'm sure she'd love that.
We would.
For all of our listeners who haven't read Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged, Ayn
Don't.
Rand is an interesting character. Don't. She's an interesting character. There was a guy who oh, they can't, they're not gonna see the video, are they?
No. No, we don't know how to do that.
Who gave me those books in high school, who is a firm libertarian, and if you read them, which I did in high school because I thought, oh, I'll be cool and
Yeah,
do that.
I read
It's
The
just,
Fountainhead.
it's an insane exploration into individuality and selfishness,
Yes. Oh, yes. I
basically.
read The Fountainhead when I was in seminary. And I think I was like initially just reading it because it was like, of course you like this is if you're like gonna read the classics, you have to read Ayn Rand. And so I didn't really know a ton, except that when my dad saw that I was reading her, he was like, oh, he goes, I used to be a really big fan of hers because I believed like all that philosophy, but it's really terrible and anti-Christian. And I was like, oh, interesting. Okay.
It's
And then like,
very anti-communal, I'll say it. It's very much about like the
yeah,
individual's
which I think is what
ability
he
to.
was intending for, like he was like, this isn't how Christians should treat each other, you know, or treat other people. It's like we're not
Right.
individuals, but
And
like
like the self-actualization of like I can do anything.
by myself.
I don't
Yeah.
need
I don't
anyone
need anything
else.
else. Yeah. And then so and I liked The Fountainhead. I will say I liked The Fountainhead.
Yeah, the books aren't bad. I don't think she
Well,
intended this to be taken the way it did.
she did because she had a whole
You think so?
oh yeah no because she had a whole thing. It was like she was going around teaching this. This was like a
Oh, never
very
mind.
big
Chris, don't listen to me. I've just
yeah
read the books and knew a couple libertarians. Christy is the expert
no
on. I
no
like to give people the benefit of the doubt that
she was like
she
a
did.
she was like a much worse person actually. Like
Oh,
she's bad.
well, I mean, I'm
So
not entirely
I
shocked.
should know nor no but so I didn't read Atlas Shrugged because Atlas Shrugged is huge. It's a monstrous book. And then I was working at the aforementioned school that I was working at, which was a Christian liberal arts university. And the president of that school was like a massive Ayn Rand fan and was like constantly talking about how we needed to base all of our like efforts and school philosophy stuff. Again, at a Christian school where he was repeatedly saying things like, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Was like touting this. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna read this book and see. And I was sitting there reading that book and I just wanted to drown myself in a river. I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever read.
Picked this book up since like probably 1999, and it says in the back, in any Ayn Rand novel, you found more than great works of art, you have found a philosophy of reason. Activism, the philosophy of Ayn Rand.
It's
In order to define, explain, and present my concept of man, I had to become a philosopher in the specific meaning of the term. I don't even know what that means in the specific meaning of the term. Aren't we all okay? Whatever.
No.
Yeah. Aren't we all philosophers in that way?
Anyway. Cool. Anyway, what did I just do? I'm just over here pushing buttons accidentally. Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I didn't mind the readings. I didn't know about the background, but
yeah.
Anyway, I just saw that book up here, and I was like, if Taylor asked me about philosophical leanings of Ayn Rand, I'll have no idea.
Atlas Shrugged was the beast, but
except for what I've just spouted to you, right next to a wind in the door, Madeline.
My dad told me that people who follow Ayn Rand are in a cult. He was like, I used to be in that cult.
Well, to be fair to everybody that likes Ayn Rand, we're all in cults of our own creation.
That's true. We're all in our
own. But yeah, own. I mean, I think any philosophy or political system or theological system that leans into individualism, self-actualization, and like that could sound very Buddhist, so I don't want to like take it down that road, but like I think if you move into this world of those things but also incredible selfishness, I think that's where the Buddhists don't do that. Like they have the two other parts, but they also believe in community and doing things for others and helping others to reach goals. It just feels like that's where she stops.
Yeah,
in that
she was like, nope, fuck everyone else.
Yeah. She's like, well, now that I'm self-actualized and independent, I don't need anybody. And I'm like, well,
and I don't want to help anybody.
And I don't want to help anybody. And you all are destroying my visionary genius. Yeah. And then we have J.D. Vance. And then J.D. Vance was immediately born.
And then J.D. Vance was like, this is my new J.D. Vance. Right? Anyway, so Atlas Shrugged is being used as a prop. The Fountainhead, I don't know what I did with that one. I don't like to display them, though. I have them kind of hidden away because I don't want people to think that I'm...
Mine were hidden away until I got Stuart got me a fancy new computer.
I can see everything. I am. I keep, like, looking. I'm like, let's see what books are back there, Leah.
Right. Yeah, you can. There's nothing real. There's a David Bowie.
Nice. I like that.
Biography.
How are your books organized?
Good and Bad Religion, which helped with my last... they're not.
Okay.
They just appeared.
Okay.
Gordon Kaufman, who is also my theological daddy, if you want to get weird. The Theological Imagination, right next to The Gospel According to the Klan.
Nice. Oh, that I want to read that. Kelly Baker, right?
Yep, it is indeed. So there's no real, there's no theology up there, my nemesis that I talk about a lot. And then Westboro Baptist is up here. Lily Phelps is her autobiography. There's not. There used to be, but I moved around so much with my books that I think I have PTSD from organizing them and then them becoming unorganized. I'm not going to say it's a good system and I wouldn't recommend it, but it is what it is.
One of my dearest friends and colleagues, Kyle Greenwood, is the most organized human being I have ever known. And he has his books organized. I can't remember what system he uses. It's not the Dewey Decimal System. It's a different, but it's a system like that. Like it's an official system of organizing his books. And he has it all in an Excel spreadsheet. And if you ask him where a book is, it's the most organized. No. He's the most organized human being. He's an Old Testament scholar that should flow. Like we should all be like, yep, this all makes sense. But he one time walked into my office and he said, Christy, are your books organized at all? And I said, they are. And he said, are they organized by chaos? And I was like, no, they actually are organized. I have them organized by...
I know what's happening.
Yeah, like... They're organized basically by like subject. Like my literature books are all together and then alphabetized by author. And then it's like,
Christy, you do have them organized though.
I do. But it only makes sense to me. Okay. Like if you were to walk into my office, you probably wouldn't figure it out. You might.
You have
the same.
My desk is unfortunately catered towards the chaos section because I do have like Northern Ireland, Scotland, world religions, and then like ministry stuff.
It's like topics.
And then this is
Doctrine of God, like, books are all together. Christology right. books are all together. Pneumatology
my
books
theology are books are all it actually should show you what I've been I think it's a reflection of what I'm researching as opposed to like that life is that
also I that yeah it. Like when I was yeah. doing my PhD all the books for my dissertation were in the same spot, you know. Now I have different yeah. books that are in like a easily accessible spot, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this yeah, is the research this is the research section, so it's yeah. just chaos.
If
here.
You, if again, you probably would be like, oh no, this makes sense now. But most people would walk in and just like, did you just like vomit the books onto the shelves?
If it works for you, I don't, I mean, at it's this just, stage, I don't know. I have too many.
I don't know who the authors are half the time. I know what book I want, but I can't remember the author's name. And so if it was like organized by alphabetizing by last name of the author, I would never find any books. I'd be like, what book is this?
You'll appreciate this. So I have copies of my three books, Humble Brag, yeah. but they're lost currently somewhere in. So I wanted to make sure because I was going to that AAR conference, I was going to sell some of my books, but I want to make sure because you only get so many free copies.
Yeah.
That I have at least one. I know I have one of my first one, which is I only have one. Okay. And then I have like 45 million of Bad Theology. And then I have like six of Bad Theology and COVID. So I needed to make sure that I didn't sell one of my own copies, which I have done in the past.
Yeah. Because that would suck.
But they're lost in here. And I wrote them, but I can't find them.
Can't find them.
So that's a problem. that's an academic problem to have. So if you have one of my books, you want to sell it back to me, that's cool too.
I had the same thing happen with mine because I got so many free copies. And then I like a couple of people were like, can I just buy that copy from you? And I was like, okay. And then the next thing I knew, I didn't have a copy for myself. And I was like, now I have to buy a copy for myself. Because you should have your own book.
My dissertation, well, now the COVID book is a problem because it's in hardback, but originally when it was just two, my dissertation was like $75 on Amazon. No, I know. Which
it is like $75 because I looked.
It's fine, like, maybe, but I didn't have a copy for years and years and years. And then may she rest in peace. My grandma passed away, and I got a whole box of her stuff, and actually in it was one of the book.
Oh, that's very yeah. sweet.
Oh, yeah. So I'll find it. So it came back to me via that. And I'm glad it was that because I have a little inscription to her inside for it. So that's kind of yeah. nice to have that. So that's my one copy of that. And then that the other nice. Two I just have. So but thankfully no one's passed and left it to me now. But so, yeah. Welcome to Theology on the Rocks, guys.
Yeah, welcome. We're Christy
and I have books. We have books.
We have books.
We have.
We also have drinks. I want to take a sip of this because I'm curious.
Me too, because I have a big spherical ice.
We decided to. Did you use spherical ice? Yours is fancy.
Who do you think did this?
Stuart did it for you. Got it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
100%.
Cheers.
Ooh.
Look, I know.
We'll talk about the difference in color in a minute as well.
Mm.
Oh, that's tasty.
Oh, I like that.
Now it's heavy on the whiskey whisk.
It is heavy on the whiskey whisk. So we decided to do a St. Patrick's Day cocktail, and I have the Drinking with the Saints book via our bestie Catherine. So this is
Catherine.
This is a Irish ale cocktail, which is supposed to be Irish whiskey and lime and ginger beer. And I'm not usually a big fan of ginger beer, but this is really tasty.
It works with the lime. There's something about mm-hmm. it that's helping. Also, I will say I have hibiscus whiskey heavy. Ginger beer. That's why mine's a different color.
Yeah, yours
color.
Is hibiscus. How's that hibiscus ginger beer?
I think it's making the difference for me. I think it would be, it needs a little fruit with that whiskey for me.
What kind of whiskey did you use?
Well, you're setting me up because you know what kind of whiskey I used. which is fine. It's not my fault that I live in an oppressive household. I mean that in the least real way possible. All right. So we have I'm not using Jameson. That's what I wanted to use was Jameson. Because it doesn't have to be a fancy
Well, right, it just said Irish whiskey. It didn't say anything like specific.
But it's Johnny Walker because Stuart said it was basically the same thing. And he's so he let me tell you something about the Scottish and the Irish. Which tasting it, I feel like it probably is kind of the same thing. It's just like a blended whisk. It's not like a fancy whisk.
Yeah.
The Scottish have what I would like to call a charm off with the Irish.
Yeah.
In the sense of that they want to be more charming. And honestly, as a Southerner who also likes to be, I mean, we have shows called Southern Charm. Like, we want to be charming too.
You do.
But yeah. We know that we can't out-charm the Irish. So I'm not sure what the Scottish think that they're going to do to the Irish either. The Irish are just charming.
I have theories about this.
I want to hear them. But I will say, I think it's the irreverent, drunken, laissez-faire nature, but also, you know, this like bootstrap, I'm going to survive kind of thing too. And I studied, I taught a class on Scottish and Irish history with Scott Spurlock, actually, at University of Glasgow. We co-taught that at Edinburgh and Glasgow. And he did the Scottish parts and I did the Irish parts. And I learned a lot. It still doesn't explain to me, though, what's going on.
My theory is entirely made up of my own notions and not based on any conversation.
Well, that's why it's your theory.
I've had with anyone. But okay. I feel like because two things. One is that Americans tend to mix up Irish and Scottish stuff a lot. Like,
I saw a lot of kilts in those parades for
a lot of kilts and a lot of bagpipes.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, this is Irish. And it's like, actually
you've just combined a bunch of stuff.
You've just combined two cultures into one. And there's not any kind of sense of like, and I think that because everything is assumed to be Irish, I think the Scottish get a bit of a like chip on their shoulder because it's like, we exist and we are not Irish. And you're all, but you're also like using all of our stuff and pretending like it's Irish. And I think that's where, at least.
Yeah, I sometimes will work at a local bar just so that I can have fun sometimes. And I worked on the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day. And there was a guy who came up and he was, I mean, just grotesquely decked out. I said something, I was like, oh, you know, I don't know if, because I was talking about Stuart and I said, I don't know if he'll be going crazy. And then the guy said, because I knew him, he was from here, a local guy. And he goes, well, if they had their own day, we would do that for them too. And I went, they do have their own day.
They do.
And he goes, oh. He went, oh, what's it called? I said, St. Andrew's Day. And he goes, oh, I haven't heard of that one.
See, and this is it. I feel like, well, the Scottish are like, we have a day. We have the kilts and the bagpipes. We drink too.
Yeah.
Why don't we have big parties for us? You know,
I get it. I would be really upset because you do have, and if you talk about in the States, like you did have a lot of Scottish immigration as well. It's not just as I proudly stated that Chris and I were going to talk about Ireland today and celebrate St. Patrick's, you know, I'm using Scottish whiskey so that I can honor Stuart's background.
I'm going to admit something to you as well, that I also have Scottish whiskey, and it's because I don't have any. My options were Colorado whiskey or Scottish whiskey, and I felt like Scottish whiskey at least was like,
it's not Scottish, there. Is it?
It is.
Is it? Oh, dear Jesus Christy. He's going to be even more mad at you. He's going to be more mad at you for that.
Well, it's a cheap one. It's not a good one.
I know, but
I used a like mess.
Just close your ears.
But it's all I had.
I know. I'm not mad. But he's just going to be disappointed, honestly. But you might be mad, actually, about that one. That one's a sacred one. But I think, yeah, the Scottish approach. I mean, Christy and I both got our degrees in Scotland. I lived in Ireland for a year to do my field work. And it is very different. I mean, they're a very different culture. So it's interesting they get amalgamated. I think they get amalgamated in so much as it's a transplant to the States in the in a way. Like, I don't necessarily see that happening in the British Isles, like the bagpipes and the kilts and then just the shamrock.
Yeah, no. And I feel like I realized how much, like when I first moved to Scotland, and I realized how much our celebrations are just like nonsensical mishmashes of things. And then I felt bad about it. And I was like, oops.
Which,
like,
is kind of how we should describe the American people, is a, what did you say? Mishmash, or ridiculous mishmash?
Just a miss, like an absolute chaotic mash of like, here are thoughts or things that we think are maybe associated with a culture, but we didn't actually put effort into figuring that out or making sure it was correct or doing any kind of homework. Let's just get drunk, you know?
Let's get drunk. I mean, that's it.
That's what we do on all sorts of, like Cinco de Mayo. We don't, half the time, we don't even know what that's about. And we're just, let's get drunk. And so, you know. Let's drink. Anyway, here's
Cheers to St. Andrew.
Cheers to both of them.
Isn't it in November, I think?
You know, we should St. know Andrew's that. Day? We should know
I
that. Should,
I mean, I would top the class. I should. I know Burns Night's in January. But so that's the, I will say it doesn't help that my long-term boyfriend before Stuart was from Northern Ireland as well. That probably is not like a, it's not helpful to the cause, but I think it is one of the things every year where we go out and Stuart's just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, what is happening?
Why?
Like, he understands the July 4th stuff, but he'll go out and like, he is, I think, yearly amazed by our dedication to the green. And then he's also, I think part of it too is because he's with me, and like, this isn't me being a contrarian. I've never really dug into my history because I think it felt like a lot of work. I will probably one day when I don't have to research other things, I probably will do that. I know my last name's Robinson, but like, and there's a back, my mom's maiden name's Baxter, so that's probably Scottish. But like, I don't know, like, I know two branches very specifically, but I, the sort of Euro branches, I have no idea.
My niece, my oldest niece, did all of our genealogy for us. And so I know on my dad's side, we had been told, and this is also, I think, again, part of what I was saying earlier, we were told my whole life that we were Irish, like 100%. My grandparents would swear up and down that we were completely Irish. My grandma would always be like, oh, you're such a good Irish girl. Like, it was huge thing. Wow. It was a lot. We're not Irish, like, at all.
It's like her brain just explodes.
So I write, if she ever knew. So my niece did all of this background on our family, and basically, we were English nobility who were, but they were the ones who like were in charge of a part of Ireland. So we were basically the oppressors of Ireland. We were the bad guys.
Yeah.
And then
that tracks.
And then during Oliver Cromwell's time, we were on the wrong side of things there.
Oh no.
And Christy. So we had to flee to America. So that's when the Whaleys came to the States.
You were on like maybe one of, if not the, other than the snakes, the biggest villain of Ireland's, like, the whole country.
No, yeah, we're like
basically you were on the side of their biggest villain.
We're completely the bad guys in all of that. And so when I found that out, I was like newly fresh in Scotland, and she found out like we were the bad guys there. One of our ancestors was the guy who destroyed all of the monasteries during the Reformation, went around and destroyed them all. Except for his own. So that's the only one still standing. We're the Sheriff of Nottingham is back there too. Like, we're constantly the bad guys. And that continued in the States for quite some time as well. So.
Okay. Well, at least
all
you
of
know.
The like sheen of like, I'm Irish, this is my holiday, you know, just all of a sudden kind of fell away. And then I was living in Scotland.
You
and
probably
I was like,
should not celebrate it at all.
I know.
You should probably go to church and pray about it.
Right? I put black on and I repent. on behalf of my ancestors. So sorry. We were.
Yeah, kidding. I mean, so the part-time historian, a great deal of the South was not colonized, but was occupied by Scots-Irish. So it's very possible. But I mean, again, I haven't done it. I don't.
Yeah.
And we did have someone in my family who did go back to, that was in the Baxter line. And I mean, that, if you've ever had Baxter soup, it's a pretty big name in Scotland. So I think it's fairly easy, that one. The Robinsons are a little more difficult because you would say that's kind of a Scandinavian name, but then you also get a lot of Robinsons in Northern Ireland and weirdly the Lake District. If you ever I always stand in front of places if it's Robinson and you'll see the picture of me with peace signs over and over. I'll put some up on our Instagram. The Lake District, Stuart will tell you, like, every other place was called like Robinson's Cafe, and that's so hilarious. Apparently a bunch of them went to the Lake District.
Oh, that's too funny.
Yeah, so who the freak knows. Yeah. I mean, I always tell people the person who I'm most interested in is like the person who decided to leave, you know, and to come over. And
oh, see,
I mean, out with like, being associated with Oliver Cromwell, like Christie was.
It was such a big, like, they had to flee because he was Oliver Cromwell's brother-in-law.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Yeah, you'd think he'd need to if he was
really bad. And then we got to the States, and so there's in one of the Carolinas, I think it's North Carolina, but I'm never really, I can never remember. There's a Whaleyville. You can go to my town. But they got into a fight.
You also have quite a weird last name, I will say. That's maybe what put it, not weird, but like unique. That's put me off a little bit because I have the name of like, there's a reason why all of the jerseys of my teams I like, I can get one that says Robinson.
Yeah, it's much easier to do my history.
Some like, slavery history there maybe or whatever, but I think also it's just a very common last name.
Yeah. So Whaleyville, when they were settled there, and then there was a massive fight, and like half of them then moved to Missouri in the Ozarks, and that's the half I'm from. And then and then they became moonshiners and stuff, and then got involved in the mafia, and then anyway, and then it just continued. Like,
well, the Ozarks would be more like Missouri area, though.
Yeah, like Missouri. I mean, Grandpa was in Missouri, and then he moved to Colorado. So like, this is where my dad's side. My mom's grandparents came over from the Czech Republic in the early 1900s. So that one's easy. We know them. I met them. They didn't speak English. You know,
I mean,
that one's
my VZ grandparents and my Francisco grandma, that side we're good with.
Yeah,
the Robinson and the Baxters are still up for debate. We'll see what they do.
Yeah,
because I feel like there's always four strands coming in at the same time.
There's like mesh anyway, but yeah. So ever since I discovered this St. Patrick's Day, I've just felt weird about it. I feel like I can't celebrate it anymore.
We just like make it into like a Disney World version of itself. And I've been in Northern Ireland for St. Patrick's. Now, of course, Northern Ireland has its own complicated situation with those holidays. But even in the Republic, like it's not, this is an us thing. We really just, I think it's also, Stuart and I talked about this at the bar, even us, you and I going on this kind of like, here's my four strands discussion is a very American thing. Because if you ask him, he'll be like, oh. Like his dad's Scottish and his mom's English, and he's like that's about as far as it goes.
He's like, that's it. That we're just that. I think there's a desire, and again, you and I and Taylor talked about this once because you and Taylor are from the South, and I mentioned this before, but there's a desire to have a culture and to be able to connect to a specific history, and a lot of Americans just, I think we really have like a hole there because we don't have that. Clear.
I think so. And I think with, to a fault sometimes I will say, but I think with Southerners, I haven't cared about this because I feel like I'm already a part of that group. So I'm not saying we've contributed. We're at a very, I would say 25-75 level of positive and negative, 25 being the positive. You could skew those as well pretty hard, but we've got a little music and food, but that's about it. So, I mean, but that slavery thing is really gonna send our numbers off. I'm sorry, we're not allowed to talk about that anymore.
You know, I think they've DEI'd that out or something.
Yeah, you can rip that from my dead cold hand as well. But I think that there is a little bit of that in the sense of feeling as though you're already kind of a part of some distinct bit too. And you talk about it, like being out west. I mean, when I talked to Christy a lot, and I was sitting in Miami for this thing and for that AR Southeast event, and I was by myself and I was about to leave, but my flight was at a god awful time at night. And so I just was getting margaritas at this restaurant. I was like, oh, you might as well. And a mariachi band just showed up. And I was like, now I'll tell you what doesn't happen in the South. Mariachi bands just showing up. I mean, probably on occasion, but I was just like, oh. And then you said, well, anyway, I won't say what you said, but I was just like, I felt such pressure when they showed up because no one else was on the porch and they were just playing at me. At me is the only way. And it was delightful and wonderful and amazing, but I just was like, my eyes were like this big. Like, I don't know.
Because
there was just no one else out there.
There's just, I have, that experience has happened to me 1,000,000 times because there's always, if you're at a Mexican restaurant in Colorado, there is a mariachi band. And
yeah,
you're almost always one of like three tables. So they're just going to play at you because there's no one else, you know?
Yeah.
They were amazing. I'm very used to it. But also, like, I think this is a big part of what I miss so much when I go to like Mexican restaurants in Florida. I'm just like, there's this lack of atmosphere. I think I need a mariachi band to
go down, south a little bit more. Go to Miami.
Gotta go find those mariachi bands. They're ubiquitous in Colorado. There's a mariachi band.
So, speaking of culture, it was insane to be in that part of Florida, which is so different from what I would say is the southern part of Florida, like the panhandle, and then like your part of Florida, which feels a little culturally ambiguous to me, honestly.
Yes,
less gorgeous, but a little, I'm not quite sure where it sits. And going to South Florida, where honestly, I felt bad for not knowing Spanish and I was in America.
Yeah.
I feel that often, but like, when I say I spoke to, other than at the conference, I don't think I spoke to a single person that was like, where English wasn't their second language. Yeah. And I just felt bad about it.
Yeah.
Like the whole time. And, you know, I think that is a culture in and of itself. Of course it is. But I mean, just a really interesting thing to visit when you see. And also Christy and I were talking about picking apart the different, like I would talk to people from Cuba and people from Mexico and just to pick apart all the different like nuances that come from what we would call, you know, Latin culture, which of course is such a big, huge thing.
Yeah. It's so,
with its own
kind of put these umbrella terms over these places, but they're so different. And like when you start to see them just like Ireland and Scotland, two very different cultures that we've kind of meshed together out of laziness.
That's right.
And we do that with Latin cultures as well. Like, or like African cultures or, you know, Asian
100%.
Cultures half the time. We're just like, all of this is probably the same because, you know.
Right. In my textbook for African traditional religions, it just says we put African traditional religions is kind of a category in religious studies. And it's getting more nuanced now, but it was for a very long time. Just every religion of every tribe of every country in Africa is ATR, right?
Yeah.
And it's one of these things where it's said in the textbook I was teaching out of, which was not that, it was recently published. This is because we haven't studied it enough. They actually admitted it. They're like, we haven't studied it enough. So that's why it's there. We haven't done the work. And I just thought that was a wild thing that they would just sploosh all that together.
I almost am like proud of them for admitting it, but like,
Yeah.
It's true though. We have this tendency, or we do it with like this idea of indigenous religions, but like indigenous religions are so vastly different, especially if you're not even trying to narrow it down to a place. Like, goodness, but we do this. Like, you know, you and I both, when we teach world religions, I get two class periods to talk about indigenous religions. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, guess what? We cannot cover indigenous religions even in a tiny bit in two class periods. Like,
and do you include the ones like Aztec, Inca, like Egyptian, Greek, right? Like, Roman, like the ones that are what you would maybe call, people don't practice. I'm sure some people do, but I don't know.
The like most like smaller, mostly dead ones, you know?
Like, yeah. Like it, yeah. I don't know how you call a religion dead. That's a question in itself. But I don't know the answer. So I don't either.
I mean, because you would think this with like Greek, right? Greek religion. Yeah, yeah. You'd be like, oh, this is dead. But like,
I'm it's sure not there's fully,
that, like there's still people
that's right
doing that. I know there are still people practicing like Mayan and stuff, but like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did have to teach it in one of my classes when I taught that Eastern humanities class a couple years ago. We covered Maya and the Aboriginal indigenous religion in Australia as well. And just the immense amount of unpreparedness that I am for teaching this many indigenous religions.
Right.
It was like, well, I need seven more degrees to do this. This is a lot.
And about seven more classes. I mean, the reason I asked that wasn't to like put you on the spot. It was because I didn't teach Aztec, Incan, Egyptian, or
in my world religion class, we do Lakota and we do Yoruba, and those are the two that we cover.
I did American Indigenous, I did African traditional religions to get their own 2 days. Good for them. But I did also Aboriginal Indigenous traditions too. But again, you're quite right, we're very unqualified for it. And honestly, just having to make those choices, it felt kind of upsetting in a way, because like I don't have to, I mean, you always have to leave stuff out, but you're giving a whole week to Christianity, for instance. I'll use my own tradition, and or a whole 2 days or whatever your week is, like teaching, and then you have to do all of the indigenous in 2 days. Like,
exactly, right? It's like
Christianity can't even be covered in 2 days, let alone indigenous as the big blanket term.
We just spent, before spring break, we spent a whole week covering Zoroastrianism, which is an incredibly important religion, and I 100% believe we should spend a week covering it. But 200,000 people practice that in total, worldwide. Right. And then we're like, let's give half of a class period to Yoruba, which is one of the like biggest religions. And it just gets this like 20
It'd be interesting to do a paper or something on world religions classes and how we weight certain traditions over others in textbooks and things like that.
Well, I know there's another duo of two female professors that do a podcast called Keeping It 100 or Keeping It 101. I can't remember exactly. And they talk about world religions, but they have talked about this very issue. I don't know if they've written anything about it or if there's a paper out there, but
we should do a combo.
We should join forces with them.
Yeah. So taking it back to Ireland.
Yes.
So I did my PhD on Northern Ireland, on the Troubles, theology. I did an ethnographic study that you could also argue is constructive and systematic and everything else, because it's the UK. And history, very history heavy, I will say.
All of the things.
All of the things. And I did interviews and stuff with people and sort of tried to construct what would create a theology of reconciliation. So what was the background that led them? It was also kind of sociology as well, as to say, like, what are the things that we can intervene on that would make someone who is in the same country come to theological conclusions that reflected more reconciliation and peace building versus violence, which was also, that was kind of the precursor to bad theology, which I talk about a lot. It's, I would talk to some people, not of my own accord, not that I wanted to, but that sort of demanded to be talked to and heard. as they do, about their theologies of violence. Now, I didn't include that in the PhD because my advisor quite rightly was like, I don't touch that right now. I got to touch it later. Sounds creepy, but she was right. of course she was. she was kind of the opposite of Heather in that way. Heather was like, include everything. And like,
Heather's like, Cecilia include everything. Like, Cecilia's like, include as little as possible.
Yeah. I don't actually use, here's an interesting thing. I don't use the word sectarianism once in my PhD. It is, you can't find it.
I mean,
it's because
I absolutely support that decision. Yeah. Was it very hard to not say it?
So sectarianism, if you guys don't know, is this idea. Specifically, it can be any group. You could say Sunni and Shia Muslims, they're sectarian. It's basically any group within a specific recognized, I would say, religion, but they're divided inside of the religion and they're fighting. Like Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland would be a key example of sectarianism.
Yes. Yeah,
but she was like, it's too contested, so you don't see it a single time, because I went and used it. I was like, thesaurus.
I was going to say, how hard was it for you to keep that aside, like to keep wanting to say sectarianism and having to avoid it?
And having to use it. I was just like, they're in a fight. They're in a fight. It was really hard. And also, I'm like you, I'm quite stubborn. And I was back then as well. Now I'm like learned stubborn, but back then I was unlearned stubborn, which is its own beast. And so I think with her, I always say that I could have never had another PhD supervisor other than Cecilia, because she was no joke, she was much taller than me and I'm 5'8". And just sort of like no nonsense. Like she was, she used to be a nun, like Catholic, like just, you know, lived in Ireland, she had to be all of these. She's like Sister Mary Michael from the Dairy Girls.
Yes.
Except like less side quips of hilarity.
Okay. Like just very serious.
And I need.
Yeah.
But yeah. And didn't wear the garb clearly because she was not in that world anymore. But I needed that because I kind of needed to fear her a little bit. And like I didn't grow up Catholic, but man, I felt like I did for those 4 years. Oh, she ran a tight ship, and like I appreciate it, because so I think the annoying thing for me was not so much that I couldn't, well, it was that I couldn't use word, but it was that I didn't understand why I couldn't use. Now I do.
Oh yeah.
Now I'm like, oh, she was right.
Yeah.
Shock.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing for all you folks getting PhDs out there. Just know that unless you have a real jerkwad of a supervisor, they're typically looking out for you.
Yes.
I think, and listen to them if you trust them in that way, because I now look back and I'm like, of course I didn't do that.
I think the best advice I ever got was to find a supervisor that you could trust, and then also like when you're doing your dissertation, to hold it very loosely and not get too precious about it, because if they tell you like you need to do this or that, or you need to cut out this or that, you need to do that and not like cling on to it with all your might, because you're just going to suffer. That's just going to hurt you in the long run. Like you said, they know what they're doing. You should trust them.
The phrase that I've used that she gave me, I use it all the time. You'll have heard on this podcast, is she said, and I now, sorry, I now realize that she used it because she could see the stubbornness in me. Like she kept saying to me, this is not the last thing you're going to write.
Yeah.
Now, and she was, my God, was she right? I wrote a whole book on bad theology that starts with me using that bit for my dissertation.
Yeah.
That I couldn't put into my PhD. So it's like she, I think she was trying to keep me off the edge of the cliff by saying that, but she could also recognize that I was already wanting to skip to the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was trying to get me past that thing. And I know a lot of people who are in this world that want to skip on without sort of having to pay the dues. And as far as we are in 2025, you've got to pay those dues. And I was being a bit of a baby about it. And I just wanted to be like, well, why can't I use sectarianism? That's what it is. She was like, if you go into that Viva, they are going to spend a solid hour talking about that one word.
Yeah.
And you know what never got brought up in my dissertation?
Sectarianism. Which is great.
And I was like, freaking right.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's... So here's my question, though. As somebody who studied sectarianism, like, when you're thinking about a kind of ultimate... If there's a ultimate issue going on, right? We've been talking about this. Like, we tend to be too lazy to like really understand, okay, here's Scottish culture, here's Irish culture, here's this or that. Mm-hmm. like, what is the misunderstanding or the like thing that you think is happening with sectarianism in terms of that kind of situation
in Northern Ireland or in Scotland?
I mean, just generally, but you can specifically talk about Northern Ireland if you want.
That it's about religion.
Okay.
Honestly, it's about identity, I think.
Yeah.
And I think those are, they can be one and the same thing, but that they're not, as it goes. Like, I think religion, well, no, I'm supposed to not say I think. She also taught me that. Don't say I think, say it is. sectarianism in Northern Ireland, and I would argue in Scotland as well, religion was used as fuel to the fire. I would say it's something that makes you passionate. It's something that makes you feel things. We can see this in America right now, honestly, if you want to think of a parallel.
Yeah.
And political affiliation, social status, all of that sort of stuff is being used, and it's being manipulated, and it's being used by people who are in power to keep power, but also to divide people who they want to keep subservient in a way.
Yeah.
Because if you're fighting at a football game about, you know, Rangers versus Celtic, then you're not really screaming about someone who's cutting your benefits and that kind of thing. You know, that it's a distraction in a way. And so I would say the idea that people think it's about religion or politics or football or any of that, I would say, no, it's about, it certainly is about identity, but it's a manipulated identity.
It's an identity
that people are using to keep power.
I think that's such an important thing for us to think about, like you said right now too, because what I think we're realizing, especially in this past week, is that Republican and Democrat, for the most part, for those of us who are the normal people, we have far more in common in terms of the situations that we're in, the things that we need, and like what we can and can't do to fight for things. And the people in power are using, and for a lot of it, it's using things like religion, but it's also using buzzwords, you know, so that you can start throwing out insults without actually knowing what those things mean.
Well, they've seen what gets us all up in arms, you know,
like getting really hung up on religion and politics. Getting really
all of that
kind of like the Republican that started in the 80s or whatever with like the switch on abortion issue. Like SBC used to be pro choice. And switching over into this in kind of incredibly extreme way of understanding abortion and what kinds of stuff is going on is so manipulative just to keep people voting Republican, so that you have so many people who say like, well, I'm a single issue voter or whatever. And what because I only got to spend a weekend in Belfast, and it was one of my favorite cities that I've been to, even though it was such a short period. I had every intention of going back. I've spent much more time in the Republic of Ireland than I've been there several times, but I felt like in the Republic, you could almost kind of ignore some of the stuff that, especially because I was mostly in the South in Kerry, and it wasn't so in your face. And whereas like in Belfast, it was from the moment I flew in, it was very in your face about these issues. And I just kept having that same sense of, this isn't actually, like you said, it's not a religious divide. It's also not a political divide in the way that it seems like it is. But what is keeping people from being able to have that conversation? And I think you're quite right.
Well, it's I think
people in power keeping them from having that conversation.
And I think Belfast, if you ever go, is a real, you know, we look at the world we live in now, it is a real, warning as to what it could become again, I would argue.
Absolutely.
Because under Jim Crow, we certainly had,
I mean, the murals, there's walls, are just there's the wall.
All of the buses in Belfast, you can't go from, I used to live in the Holy Lands, which was near, it was sort of in between lands. It's where students lived.
Mm-hmm.
So there, it was kind of like a mixed bag. But to get to the Falls Road or to get to the Shankill, which are two quite predominant roads in terms of Catholic and Protestant folks, you had to go through the city center. Well, the buses, as it works, is that you have to get off at the city center and then you have to get on your respective buses to go to these places. Now, the reasoning behind that is so you could, what the government tells you is that people will fight. So it means that if they have to be on the same bus together, so we have to separate them and they won't fight and peace will be had, right? Mm-hmm. Now, think about that in terms of what we had in the bus boycotts and things like that.
Yeah.
If we keep them separate, they won't fight. So this is for your own good. That's the rhetoric you're getting.
Yeah.
It's for your own good. If we don't put kids in Belfast in school together, that's why there's Catholic schools. That's why there's Protestants. Very easy to figure out which or which. Put a saint in front of it, you're at a Catholic school. You know, well, we need to keep them separate to keep the peace, right? Yeah. To keep the peace. Think about this in our context in the U.S. It's bullshit. It's not real. Trying to do is they're trying to keep you separate. And not only separate, but they're trying to keep you afraid of the other person. Because once you sit down and you start talking and you start having conversations with folks and you're like, oh, well, you don't have horns under your hair. Like, what do you mean? Well, then you start to become a community, going full circle to Andrian.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start getting powerful and you start rising up and saying, well, actually, you've told us a lie. Like, you've not separated these buses to keep us from fighting. You've separated them so we don't get to know each other.
Yeah.
And that to me is, I did a lot of work in the reconciliation communities, Corey Mila, Cornerstone, and other ones that were Clonard Monastery, blah, blah. Once you got these kids together, I said how I was talking to a leader of Corey Mila, and it was out by the beach. It was in this kind of neutral zone, Ballycastle. And I talked to the leader and I said, what's the first thing you do when you bring in these Catholic and Protestant kids? Like, how do you get that? He's like, I throw a football on the ground. And I said, what do you, you don't give them a chat? He goes, no, I don't talk to them. He goes, I throw a football on there. And you know what they start doing? They start picking teams. And I was like, oh God. So they start dividing up. And he's like, no, they figure out who's good at football. And that's who they pick. And I was like, oh, he goes, these kids don't know. I mean, they're not, and it's not just kids, you know, it's, I was taught my whole life that, you know, about stuff like the separate but equal thing in terms of race in the South. And it's absolute and total bullshit. It is not real. Well, first of all, that phrase is not real and it isn't real. But it's also this idea that, like, when you actually start getting people together, you know, and it becomes a norm, that's the most powerful thing that you have against these people who are trying to divide you. So when you talk about sectarianism, all I see is we talk about them and the government and whoever's up top. You know what? It's the people. It is the government, actually. Like, it's these people who create the. And honestly, I think what we're seeing is, sadly, a retaliation against us pushing back against a lot of this stuff that they wanted to use to control. And sorry, this is my whiskey rant, Christy. No, I'm whiskey weak. I re-listened and I said I'm whiskey weak. Or no, I'm liquor weak.
You did. And we're like, let's have whiskey.
Let's have whiskey and then talk about Northern Ireland.
Cool.
Anyway, just know that it's being used. If you have suspicions of people like, oh, they're taking our jobs, or oh, you can't marry someone who's X, Y, and Z, or oh, my kid's X, Y, and Z, and that means they're terrible. No, that rhetoric is being told to you to make you do something that someone else who's above you socioeconomically and politically to make you think so.
It's, and I think this is the biggest thing that, I don't know. I do feel that I see this happening in real time here is, there's a kind of awakening of many people on, again, Republicans and Democrats realizing that the politicians are not for us.
Right.
Especially the higher up ones, like president currently definitely is not. But like, we can't assume those things because we have to be more community, but like there's like conversations. Oh, like, yes, we do need to be concerned about all of these government organizations, including the ones that maybe we weren't always so concerned about before. You know, the left has not always been great at working or thinking about veterans. And like, we've kind of relegated veterans and vet stuff to the right because we associate the military with the right. But like, we should fight for them too. You know, like, we should be caring about all of these things. And I think that is exactly what you're saying. They've been trying to keep us so separated to have this. And that was the thing that I noticed too when I was in Belfast. One of the days I was there for a conference on theopoetics, and it was called God After God Symposium. And it was really lovely kind of conversation about the ways that of talking about God through theopoetics. And then I had stayed an extra day because I wanted to be able to do a little bit of sightseeing and stuff, because I genuinely never thought I would be able to go to Belfast. It wasn't like on my list of places because I was scared of it for a long time. I was like, that's where bad things happen. Like,
yeah,
you know, it felt
my mom cried when I told her I was doing my field work there. She was very upset about it.
Like, it just felt like it was a really scary thing. And so I was like, you know, I want to have a day in Belfast. And so I did, as I always do, if you put me anywhere that has a hop on, hop off bus, I'm going to do it.
Don't do it.
And so I did. And it was a great tour because they took us through all sorts. We went through all of the neighborhoods, like Catholic, Protestant, everywhere. We went and saw all of the murals. They specifically drove us up to the wall and they talked about the wall, and they mentioned that there had been a recent vote of whether to keep it up or not, and that it had been almost unanimously voted to keep it up. And somebody on the bus was like, why do you think that is? And they said almost what you've just said, is like, they're afraid. Afraid of what will happen when it comes down. They're afraid of what.
I remember when that vote took place. It was a big deal.
Yeah, it was. And it was so heartbreaking to hear that and to see the kinds of things that, you know, there's this kind of live. It's a city that's a living memorial to the tragedy of it all. But it's also like not. I don't know. It's still happening. Like, there's the tragedy is still happening. It's just not happening with like bombs at the moment, you know?
I did the hop on, hop off bus, and I felt exactly that. It felt like I, because of having studied it, it felt like I was a voyeur, because you go down these neighborhoods where people still live. They're just walking around looking at you, staring at them like goldfish in a bowl. And it's like, they still live on this road. They still have this wall. And you were just doing a hop on, hop off bus, and this is not against them, but I it was when they opened the Titanic Museum, and I thought, I thought it was great because I love Belfast. It's one of my favorite, if it's probably my second favorite city in the world, and I love it for all that it is and all that it isn't. But it did feel like they were exploiting it. You know, because a lot of their tourism was about the stuff that happened. And even it was funny because they opened the Titanic and they were like, look, not a tragic. This isn't a tragic thing. And I was like,
it is a little bit tragic, but like,
this is a Titanic. Wow. And they would have people out in the selling the bumper stickers, built by an Irishman, sank by an Englishman. And I was like, oh, reconciliation.
Did you go to that Titanic? Yeah, fantastic. I went.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's great. It's just, but it is, and I took students there from Queen's University Charlotte before the right
before
March of 2020, right before the lockdown. And I remember sitting there and looking at stuff and thinking, they want people to think they've moved past this and they're still living it.
Yeah.
And they also want the people who live there to move past it. I remember talking to some people about the good, and again, this is a parallel to us here, talking about the Good Friday Agreement, which ultimately kind of ended what we know as kind of the troubles as they were.
Yeah.
And I remember asking a government person who was a part of the negotiation, I said, what did you do? Like, you want to know, like, how did you get these groups to sign, both sides to sign this? He goes, they got tired. And I went, he's a mediator. And I was like, what? And he was like, sometimes with conflicts so big, you have to wait for people to get tired.
Yeah.
And when they get tired of the violence, they get tired of the death. They don't care anymore what the government says. They're tired, and they're over it. And so that level of manipulation we were talking about, it doesn't work anymore, because you can't distract people with football because they're tired. And I keep that with me when looking at certain conflicts, because I think, I wonder if they're not going to get there till they're tired. And I think about that in terms of the states as well, is like, is it just going to have to get so bad.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
it's a good question. How, like, what will it take for us to be better at avoiding and overcoming the differences and getting past all that? Or are we just going to give up and say, you know what, just build a wall between us? Like,
yeah. And that's what I think. I mean, we do have moments of great bravery. I think like the civil rights movement's a great example of the people rising up.
Yeah.
Certainly possible. It and those people weren't tired. They were tireless, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
But I think there's also examples on the other side is where people just kind of said, and I think the walls, the decisions that are made now are a result of the fact that that agreement wasn't signed in confetti and flurry, despite what the end of Dairy Girls said. It was actually, I wept. If you watch Dairy Girls TV show at the end, the last episode, or at least I think the second to last, or maybe the last one, is them signing the Good Friday Agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, they've lived through this 90s time period and and they get to be a part of the vote. Yeah. But you can kind of see when they're voting, it's less about it. They're not excited like they're jumping through the roof. They're just like, we have to do this.
Yes.
It was almost like a, we're not going to make it if we don't do this.
Yeah. I think that's the vibe I got from that as well. A very sincere, this is how we stop from destroying ourselves kind of moment.
And, you know, I think you have to get that to the point where the government's like, nothing's going to, we can't manipulate this anymore. We actually have to do something. So it's either a rising up or it's a saying, we're going to annihilate each other. And I think the result of that sort of resigned piece is that they're still fearful. Like, they didn't choose that. Like, so it means those walls stay up and those neighborhoods are the way that they are. And anyway, but because I'm hopeful, the Reverend Doctor says,
yes,
we can rise up.
We can
do that. We don't have to wait to that. And we don't have to let them build the walls and do all of that. We don't have to go back to 1954.
We don't. And I am hopeful. I see these town halls that people are going to, and I see hope in them. Where they're yelling, like people are just going and yelling at politicians. I'm like, this is exactly what we need to be doing. We need to be standing up. And
when they started protesting the Tesla factories, I was like, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. There needs to be the kind of active, my computer.
Oh, I thought you were negotiating a penny.
Nope. Penny started barking. So I muted myself for a minute and then stuff popped up and I can't get it to go away. So it's fine. You can't see any of this. This is only for me. We have every possible ability. We are many. We outnumber them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have so many of the same desires and interests and experiences, and none of us are going to be billionaires. That is just not, like, we're not going to get to billionaire status, so we don't need to pretend like that's our goal. You know, I think that kind of desire of like, oh, what if I could become a billionaire and let me just like live my life as if that's a possibility. I think that's also a manipulation. Like, none of those people did that. Not one of these people is a self-made billionaire. They tell you that they are. They're not.
Mm-mm.
And then...
No, and I think with that too is when I theologically, to move it into the theology world, is that in my dissertation, at least, I talked about reconciliation, and people don't like that word. They see it as kind of a throwaway word now because the government used it so much. Mm. And I came up with this other idea of like, what if we have to have truth and justice, repentance and forgiveness operating at the same time? So in Northern Ireland, you see a real emphasis on repentance and forgiveness. Oh, you need to do this. You need to do this. But they left out the truth and the justice part of like, people can't just forgive people without having that element. And I talk about it, the theology part of that is that, you know, sometimes in order to forgive and even to learn the truth and to receive justice and to still forgive, that's reconciliation, actually. Yeah. And that sometimes takes a otherworldly event to make you be able to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, you see it in a lot of, I watch a lot of Dateline, as we talk about often. And some of the stuff where people forgive people on the stand and things like that, they don't deserve that in my mind, honestly. But they get it because the victims chose to do that. But I feel like they usually talk about, you know, I had to find, it's not always religious, but sometimes it is. But they had to find strength outside of themselves, because I don't think it's our natural inclination to forgive, honestly. I think it's not, but again, that's another manipulation. I think socially they're training us to, the reaction is to, you lose the game and you fight.
Yeah. Well, and to be outraged about stuff, you know, like,
yep.
Manufactured outrage is a huge thing right now. We get outraged mm-hmm. about everything. There's no like, oh, that's annoying. It goes straight to outrage, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's also, and I know, you know, we've talked about this briefly, but there's no like reconciliation in terms of like, is this something I need to be making a huge deal out of? Or is this like somebody made a mistake and I can like on a much smaller scale deal with it, you know? How do we differentiate between here's something that maybe needs a lot more reckoning, you know, mm-hmm. and here's something mm-hmm. that needs like a chit chat. Like, mm-hmm. how do we
right.
start to be able to tell the difference between those two occurrences instead of just constantly being like outrage?
Yeah.
And
you don't deserve and you're right. And
forgiveness.
Yeah.
And to think like
into good trouble.
Yeah. What kinds of things can we look for in order to forgive and to model forgiveness to other people? I think that needs to be a bigger discussion. Yeah.
When you, to put a bow on it, when you think about Ireland in your journey, it's not necessarily in this combo, but what is the like overwhelming feeling that you get about that place now that we've talked about, now that we're well done with our, I've definitely finished my, which is a mistake for everyone in the Robinson Gibb household.
My apologies to Stuart. This is mm-hmm. my pick for a drink. Mm. I do think that one of the things, and again, like I said, most of my experience comes from like County Kerry. I have friends that live there and spent a decent amount of time. I think the Irish people are some of the most loving human beings I've ever known. And mm-hmm. and they have this immense capacity to empathize, which I find really unique, you know, to be able to see people elsewhere. I think that I've seen this a lot with Palestine, especially, but like I saw this when I was there. Whenever I visited, their ability to just like see other people who are suffering and be like, we understand, we can empathize with you, and here's how we can help. Here's how we can come stand alongside of you. You know, I think a lot of this probably has to do with their history. You know, the suffering Ireland as a whole has gone through.
Mm-hmm.
But like they just individually, it's just like the whole, but also individually, people just are so loving and like kind. There's just a genuine kindness that's kind of that sarcastic kindness, you know, that
did I?
Yeah. they're not necessarily just going to be nice to you all the time, but they're going to be kind to you. When I was visiting my friend Kira,
just go to Temple Bar in Dublin and tell them you're American and see how it goes.
I was visiting my friend Kira in this tiny town on the coast called Kirsavine, and she had to work, and it was a Sunday. She worked at a hotel. She had to work, and so she was like, "I'm going to be at work for, you know, X amount of time," and she goes, "You can just like hang out and basically like walk around the town, see what's what, you know." Well, it was a Sunday morning in a tiny Irish town, so literally nothing was open.
Heathen.
So I stumbled finally upon a one. There was one pub that was open because it was attached to another hotel. And I went in there and there were probably only like six people in there. And they just were like, oh, welcome. Like immediately, like just took me in. And I spent the day hanging out with them and they were hilarious and great fun. And we had a lovely time, but I made all these new friends. And then she found me and she was like, where have you been? I was making new friends just at the hanging pub out. Because we were the only ones not in church. So.
Okay, this is our group chat. This is our group chat that's going off right now.
Oh, look at that.
How do I make it not ding?
I don't know.
I don't either. Okay. All right, whatever. Tell them to quit texting. So I think for me, it would definitely be along what you were saying. I spent more time in Northern Ireland than the Free State, as they call it, up in the north. Than the Republic, but certainly I would say what can come from resilience, I think, is a real thing. So people talk about the Irish charm, but you have to realize a lot of that Irish charm, if you look at the history of the famine and you look at the history of immigration and the discrimination that they got when they immigrated to the places they immigrated to because they were starving to death, the wars, the way they were used by both the continent and England, well, Cromwell there, Christie's relatives.
So sorry.
And, you know, and the North as well, and the conflict that happened there because of, I would argue, started with colonialization as well. There is this idea of things, and I feel this growing up in the South too, is that there can be something that comes from deep, deep oppression. And by the South, I'm not talking about white people, just to clarify. But I think there's a lot of cultural stuff that can come from that, from really, you know, being oppressed for so long and having such bad things happen, is that you do, as you said, become more empathetic and you do become, you know, you do produce music and art and stuff that helped you to get through. And, you know, like these sort of things that we associate with the Irish and with other places, as you said, Israel, Palestine, that was an example that I experienced too when I was there, as well as the hospitality, welcoming your, you know, the stranger in your midst. All very, again, I feel like we really have come full circle to Ayn Rand. It's like all of the stuff about community resilience and the stuff that can be built out of a community of oppression comes from, you know, is present in Ireland and the Republic and Northern Ireland from both sides of the divide, as it were. And I think it's an interesting thing we see in the U.S. as well, is that you get, I recommended this to Taylor, but the documentary, The Dirty South by Rich Hall, you know, you get music, you get rock and roll, you get gospel, you get, you know, you get all of these works of literature, even, you know, you talk about not just from people of color, but Tennessee Williams. Taylor and I talked about Tennessee Williams and this idea of like, what was it like to be a gay man in this time period, you know, like, or a gay person, you know, during this time period. And writing and how, what was it? But I think you can build something beautiful out of these things. And that is not to glamorize oppression. It's to say that the stuff that makes you resilient enough to survive oppression, I think, can create something beautiful and amazing. And to me, that's what Ireland is it's, you know, it's the clover and the leprechauns and all of that stuff are fine. But I do think the stuff that, you know, the music we play and the dances, the, you know, Irish dancing and the drinks, all of this is, you know, these were essentially coping mechanisms that they had, and they built a beautiful culture out of it.
Absolutely. I think about in my classes, I talk about this example. Basically, they call it the real life Lord of the Flies, but it is a group of five boys from Tonga who got stranded on an island for 18 months. And they eventually get found. They were able to build a raft, and a fisherman finds them and then brings them back to Tonga. But during the time that they were stranded on this island, they talk about in the little documentary I showed my students, they built you know, a way to catch fresh water for rainwater. And they built themselves like little huts, but they also built a guitar. They made a guitar out of like coconuts and stuff, and they made a badminton court. And I said, what do you think if you're stranded on a desert island and you have only so much resources, why would you choose to make a guitar? You know, like, what does this tell us? And I think that one of the things that we don't tend to think about, and one of the things that is so important in this moment, especially for us, is that life is supposed to include beauty and joy. And when we are in these moments of extreme suffering, oppression, whatever it is, to create things that are beautiful and joyful is not to ignore that, but it's to bring us out. Like, these are the things that help us survive. Because we don't want life to just be about survival. It has to also have these aspects. And I think that when you look at cultures that have such deep suffering and you realize that they also have such beautiful art, it should be a testament of, like, the reason that they have survived is the art. You know, the art isn't superfluous to the survival. The art isn't like, oh, you know, it's nice that the Irish made it through that manufactured famine, but like, and then also gave us this fun music. But it's like, no, the music is there because they were surviving, you know, like, this is part of it. Yeah. And we can.
And to know that that can also be used as a manipulation too. I mean, you saw the commercial, at least when I did one that was about the World War II guys that played soccer. They paused fighting, which was apparently a real story. The John Lewis commercial, and they came, it was like both sides came and played soccer and then they had to go back to fighting.
Yeah.
Like the next day.
Or like, and it's never like, seen
they
that.
Can use, but they can use the stuff that we use to bring joy, the art and the sport and the stuff. They can use that because they see that that brings joy. So there's manipulation. It's a means of getting you. You know?
There's that movie about, during World War I when the, German troops and I don't know my words for World War One.
It may have been World War One. It wasn't soccer.
They paused fighting to have like a Christmas dinner. They started singing Silent Night, and then they all like had a Christmas celebration. They all came together and like pooled their resources, like had a truce for Christmas. And apparently this happened pretty like all over the place. It wasn't like isolated incidents. It was like, because soldiers don't want to fight each other. Like, these aren't our wars.
It's not fun.
These aren't benefiting us. These are benefiting only those people in power. And they're the ones, you know, sending them out.
And they're trying to find joy in the midst of hell.
Find these ways to connect with the other side and realize, like, none of us want this. You know, how can we stop it? What can we do? And, like, soccer or singing or whatever is like bringing people together. Don't let them take it away then, you know?
Right. And hopefully we can rise up before we get too tired.
Yeah.
Because I think there is something, once we get too tired, we'll them separate us for the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, on that note, we love you, Ireland. We can't wait to visit again.
I know, it's been too long. I need to spend more time.
It's been 5 years, which is a lot for me, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll try to do some genealogy before I go, and I'll be like one of those Americans that are like, I just 30% Irish.
I just go over and perpetually apologize. So sorry. So sorry. So sorry.
I'm the opposite. I go over and I'm like, I did a PhD on your land.
No, it's just like they find out my last name. And this happens a lot.
They'll
be like,
oh, Christy, yeah.
They'll say like, Whaley, oh, and then I go, so sorry, so sorry.
Christy, that's a revelation right there. We should have done a trigger warning to any Irish people watching this episode.
So sorry, y'all. So sorry.
It was all her fault, really. Well, guys, I think we'll finish up. Are you cool with that, Christy?
Yeah. This is good.
Yeah.
Enjoy some real Irish whiskey if you have it.
Patreon.
We have big news.
We do have big news. Sorry, the whiskey made us forget. So Stuart helped us
We
do a Patreon. It's patreon.com/theologyontherocks.
Yes.
We're going to do our banned book book group, and we'll have a live Zoom/Zoom thing where we can all sit and chat and do a book group together. Our first book is George Orwell's 1984, so get to reading it. $5 per month if you want to do that. We are also going to record the book group so that you can watch it later. And if you do $1 a month, then you get to watch the video, and you're the only people that get to. If you do the $5, you get to watch the video as well. So that those are two tiers, because we are.
You also get to be in the Zoom. Yeah.
Yeah, you get to be in the Zoom. You get to chat with us and give us ideas for all the next stuff we're going to write and talk about. So 1984, and our date that we have put it down for is April 22nd. That's the day we're going to do our first book group.
We're super excited about it. Super excited to meet and chat with people. And we will put all of this in. We'll put the link in our linked tree, so you guys will have that. And we will put up a whole bunch of information on the Instagram, which is the only social media we actually use. Sorry, don't have Instagram. Just go to the link tree. Someday, maybe we'll have a website.
Patreon.com/theologyontherocks. And it's really as simple. Sorry, Christian.
No, you're fine. It's going to be great. We're really excited. So, So for those listening, just keep an eye on that. Again, the links are in our podcast notes as well, so you can always get the link right from where you listen to the podcast too.
But the book has been chosen, so go ahead and start. It's on the shelf somewhere.
It's at my work. I got to get it from work, but it's been a bit since I've read it. So honestly, I'm really excited because
we'll have drinks, of course, or whatever of your persuasion, and then we'll chat until we don't have anything else to say, and have a good night. Fun. Yeah. And we can promise you the money will go towards, honestly, we want to get some merch, and I think that would probably be the next thing. It definitely will not go for.
This is not going to make us rich and famous. We want to get some merch, and we want to also be able to set up a website.
Get Christy a light now, because I feel like I'm surpassing you on the light now.
Well, I have a lamp now. It's my podcasting lamp.
I'll get Stuart to buy you a computer. Like a we pay or go funding for Christy to get
fund Christy a computer. This is all going back into the podcast just so that we can have better stuff and all of that. And
but also we're doing it because it'll be fun, and we like community. I like a good book group, honestly.
Same. It's my favorite thing to do is read a book and talk about it, so this is what we're gonna do. So anyway, we'll put all this up, but thanks again. And
Slanjava.
See you next week.
Cheers. Bye.